is knowing. Crow!
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 636. Me and Jason today continuing our march through the 80s. It was interesting looking at the comments. A lot of people who I assume probably in their 40s having very fond memories of the 90s, which was the decade where they were of an age to look back on. But I don't know, for my part, Jason, there's really quite a difference between the 80s and the 90s. The beginning of the 90s is very close to the 80s, but it falls off the further we get in. How do you remember it?
Well, that was my high school days. And very quickly, within a year or so, I noticed a changeover. Definitely by 1993, whatever was left of the 80s was swept aside.
I think that's a good dividing line, Jason. In my mind, that would also be the target point that I would put my thumb on. It's just that in the 90s, we still had so many things that we remember fondly from the 80s, including how people treated one another, how we viewed one another, the supposed freedoms that we were exercising. But the march towards 9/11 is indisputable at this point.
It absolutely is. I still consider the 90s the last decade in my mind, because it's the last decade where you see definitive changes from the previous decade that you can point to and go, wow, that looks like this.
I agree. I agree all the way. But would you put the 90s to the level that you remember the 80s if you try to set aside the romantic memory of it?
There's things about the 80s I remember fondly, and there's things about the 90s I remember that are fondly. But there's things about the 90s that also irritated the hell out of me.
For me, the beginning of the 90s, I probably didn't even really notice there was a difference. But by the middle, I think it was palpable. But anyhow, let's jump in. How about if we jump in around March, springtime of 1985?
On March 11th, 1985, Mikhail Gorbachev is appointed General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, being only 54 years old at the time. He would usher in a transformative era of reform that would reshape the Cold War as well as the trajectory that the USSR would take. Mikhail Gorbachev had a background in agriculture and party administration, a huge change over the older hardliners who had been his predecessors, which reflected a desperate need to address the USSR's economic stagnation, bureaucratic inertia, and worldwide isolation. Gorbachev was inheriting a nation that was quite strained by the costly arms race, which had been exacerbated by Reagan's SDI announcement in 1983. His predecessors, Leonid Brezhnev, who had died in 1982, Yuri Andropov, who had died in 1984, and Konstantin Chernenko, who had just died in 1985, all had maintained rigid control. Gorbachev, who had been mentored by Andropov, was embracing bold reforms. Glasnost, the aim of which was to promote transparency and free expression, and perestroika, seeking to restructure the economy and decentralize power. These policies that were gradually implemented contrasted sharply with Reagan's aggressive anti-communism. Gorbachev's first summit with President Ronald Reagan would be in Geneva later in 1985. Gorbachev's rise to power was exposing economic weaknesses in the Soviet Empire, which was fueling nationalist movements in Eastern Europe and the Baltic states. His leadership, which was initially welcomed for its openness, also saw domestic backlash from hardliners. Gorbachev's ascension being set in a decade of bold Western music and significant geopolitical upheaval ended the Brezhnev-era stagnation, reshaped U.S.-Soviet dynamics, and inadvertently accelerated the inevitable Soviet collapse because, as we all know, communism does not work.
Which is an ironic way to end this, as in my entire lifetime, Russia has been the big bad enemy. And communism is bad, and we can go all the way back before my lifetime, the blacklists in Hollywood, all centralized around communism. But doesn't it feel like right this very moment, we're kind of shifting towards some weird digital form of communism?
Yeah, and Russia never really stopped being the bad guy. They just stopped playing it up for a few years in the mainstream.
I mean, they're still around, aren't they?
They're still around, and the stick is still shaking.
Yeah, it's like a permanent A-lister, right? You always wonder, how did they get to be permanent on that list?
They had to throw China in there too, because still, communism bad.
Well, let's talk in 20 years and see what we see all around us.
In May of 1985, the Parents Music Resource Center, the PMRC, is formed by Tipper Gore, Susan Baker, Pam Howar, and Sally Nevius, and will emerge as a powerful force in the 1980s culture wars, being driven by concerns over explicit lyrics in rock, pop, and heavy metal music that they believed endangered youth. Sparked by Tipper Gore's shock at her daughter's exposure to Prince's Darling Nikki from his film Purple Rain from 1984, the PMRC, which was backed by influential figures like Mike Love of the Beach Boys and Coors owner Joseph Coors, both of whom were also Reagan supporters, aimed to implement a music rating system akin to the MPAA's film ratings, targeting themes of sex, violence, drugs, and the occult. Their Filthy 15 list, that was released in 1985, highlights songs like Judas Priest's Eat Me Alive, Twisted Sister's We're Not Gonna Take It, and Cyndi Lauper's She Bop for alleged explicit content, drawing significant media attention and spotlighting heavy metal, which had gained mainstream traction via MTV. On September 19th, 1985, the PMRC's influence, bolstered by their political connections, led to a high-profile Senate hearing on porn rock before the Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation, where Tipper Gore and Susan Baker testify alongside musicians Frank Zappa, John Denver, and Dee Snider. The musicians fiercely opposed the PMRC's proposals at censorship, with Snider defending Twisted Sister's lyrics and Zappa comparing the PMRC's tactics to Nazi book burnings. Despite their arguments, the Record Industry Association of America had already agreed to a compromise, implementing a voluntary parental advisory explicit content sticker by November 1, 1985, to avoid stricter regulations. This label, while less specific than the PMRC's proposed ratings, such as X for sex or V for violence, will become iconic, though it will inadvertently boost sales for some artists by creating a forbidden fruit effect, as noted by Ice-T in his 1989 song, Freedom of Speech. The PMRC's efforts, while achieving the advisory label, would face backlash from artists like Judas Priest, whose 1986 song Parental Guidance mocked the group and inspired anti-censorship sentiments in songs by Megadeth and Todd Rundgren. Though Tipper Gore later claimed that the goal was parental awareness and not censorship, critics argued the labels enabled de facto censorship, as retailers, like Walmart, refused to stock stickered albums. The PMRC's influence would, however, wane by the late 1980s.
So we know all the players here, right, Jason? We know who Frank Zappa is. Tipper Gore is related to one of the higher ups holding office in D.C. And I'll ask a simple question. Is this how you set the stage to start running the gangster rap that's coming just around the bend? I would point out nothing has been changed or stopped or banned. They want to put a sticker on these things. And it was a big to-do. I'm sure you remember it. Do you remember the hearings they televised with Dee Snider and all that, Jason?
Oh, I remember that. Oh, yeah.
Yep. Front and center in the news. But I would remind people a very similar thing had happened with television. I want to say in the 70s, I think it was around the show or close to the show Archie Bunker. And my whole point here is they're trying to label it to warn parents. And look where we are now. Look at what's been put out in rap, or for that matter, on television. Back when they were doing it for TV, it was unheard of for any nudity or cussing of any kind to come out on TV. Look where we are now in the post-cable world. To me, this whole thing seems like a setup to prep up for what's coming in the 90s.
Those stupid little stickers were nothing but buy me stickers for once gangster rap emerges on the scene in a few years.
Good point. So even the actual effect of these ridiculous stickers that don't change a darn thing, which is having this whole hullabaloo blow up that censorship is occurring. I'm not sure how censorship occurs when you haven't changed or censored anything. They're slapping their ridiculous label on it. And the children, the young people say, oh, if it's got that sticker, it must be good. I want to buy that. So it's actually doing the opposite.
That's what we called them. My one buddy and I, we jokingly call them the Buy Me stickers.
Yeah, I think this is another clever play from the playbook. And I would urge people to go back and look when the argument was going on TV, because, and I hope I remember this correctly, Archie Bunker was saying things on television that just should not be permitted in the family hour. Is there a family hour anymore, by the way?
Good question. But the show you're referencing is All in the Family, which was huge in the ratings, spun off with The Jeffersons, which was also really popular. And even when they wanted to end it, they did a continuation of sorts. And I don't remember what they actually called it, but
I think it was Archie Bunker.
Maybe it was just the Archie Bunker show or something like that.
Yeah, All in the Family. Yep.
But it was a takeoff of that, Archie Bunker a little later in his life. And the actress playing his wife didn't want to do it anymore. So she was in a few episodes and then they had her character die.
Right. And All in the Family was a big, big deal because of the dialogue and because of the superficial kind of bigoted character that Carol O'Connor played. But again, they did this whole PMRC thing in a different way in Hollywood, the writers' guilds and all that, saying, you can't censor us. We demand free speech. Because in the 90s, when cable's here, they're going to put whatever they want on that tube.
On July 13th, 1985, the Live Aid concerts take place in London and Philadelphia. They are said to have galvanized the world, uniting music superstars and an unprecedented global audience to raise over $125 million to go towards Ethiopian famine relief, while also showcasing the 1980s musical prowess and media's humanitarian potential. Take that as you will. The event was conceived by Boomtown Rats frontman Bob Geldof, who was inspired by the 1984 charity single Do They Know It's Christmas, and co-organized with Ultravox's Midge Ure. Live Aid was said to be a response to the catastrophic Ethiopian famine that had been exacerbated by drought and civil war, which had drawn global attention through harrowing BBC reports. The 16-hour event, which was simulcast from Wembley Stadium at 72,000 attendees and JFK Stadium at 89,000 attendees, featured a stellar lineup. Queen delivered a legendary 20-minute set, with Freddie Mercury commanding the significant crowd. U2's Bono, who was always a suspect character, cemented that band's stardom with a heartfelt "Bad." Other major figures and bands like David Bowie, The Who, Madonna, and Phil Collins, who performed at both venues via taking a ride on a Concorde, electrified audiences. Live Aid was broadcast to a potential of 1.9 billion viewers across 150 nations, leveraging satellite technology as well as MTV's influence, epitomizing the 1980s media revolution. The concerts raised funds through ticket sales, telethon pledges, and merchandise, though not surprisingly, later criticism highlighted inefficiencies in aid distribution. Musically, it echoed the decade's diversity and showcased how music had the power to transcend borders, acting as an inspiration to many at the time.
No doubt that music can transcend a lot of things. Lord only knows. I don't remember how long ago, but there were hints and whispers that that money, a lot of it, didn't go where it was supposed to. I don't know if any of that's true, but it's just a good thing this was entertainment, right? Because if they wanted to program using platforms like this, I mean, that's almost 2 billion people all at once getting the same message. So it's just a good thing it was entertainment. And we had a nice guy like Bob Geldof. I think he might be famous for writing the song, I Don't Like Mondays. I think that's about a shooting where some nutbag went off and shot a bunch of people. Maybe it was a little girl. I don't really remember. But this is all in response, apparently, to something the BBC was putting on the global stage. But I remember it, Jason. Everyone remembers it. It was a heck of a thing, right?
Oh, big deal. Absolutely.
Big deal.
On October 2nd, 1985, Nintendo introduces the Nintendo Entertainment System, the NES, to the U.S. market. This ignites a gaming revolution that resurrected the video game industry from the ashes of the 1983 video game crash that had seriously hurt Atari's business that had been going strong since the late 1970s. Nintendo, with this much more powerful system, embeds itself as a cornerstone of both 1980s and 1990s youth culture. After the U.S. market collapsed due to oversaturated consoles and poor quality games from several companies, Nintendo, which is a Japanese firm known for arcade hits like Donkey Kong, reimagined home gaming with the NES, which was a rebranded version of its successful Famicom that had been released earlier in Japan. Launched initially in New York with 100,000 units, the $199 console, which is roughly $580 in 2025 money, featured an 8-bit processor, vibrant graphics, and a considerable initial library of high-quality games, starting with 17 titles that included Super Mario Bros., which introduced Mario as a global icon, a status that the little Italian plumber still holds to this day. Nintendo's strict quality controls that required developers to meet rigorous standards ensured a stark contrast to the 1983 crash's glut of subpar games, while innovations like the directional pad adding new playability to the home market, as well as the lockout chip, curbing piracy. The NES's success, which sold 1 million units by 1986 and over 60 million by 1994, was said to have been fueled by its accessibility and cultural resonance, with Super Mario Bros.' imaginative design captivating a generation. The NES offered escapism, and its colorful pixelated adventures paralleled 1980s music's bold energy, from synth pop to punk. The NES not only spawned franchises that defined gaming, but would also influence media from cartoons to the very successful The Super Mario Bros. Movie that would be released in 2023, which would cement Nintendo's legacy. It also made video games a cultural touchstone, with that market for many years now significantly outpacing films and many other traditional IPs.
I don't think it has been officially recognized in mass what a big deal gaming is. In many ways, the difference between my lifetime and the younger people I meet is that I came of age before gaming. It has really changed. It is powerful beyond. I remember when Jason, remember years ago, you told me what gaming was worth and it was more than Hollywood, all music. Do you remember that conversation?
Yeah, I do actually.
And I mean, I knew it was big, but I was blown away just how big it is. And that's before it got interactive. The NES was a big deal. So many of these gaming platforms, their names are always interesting. Is there a 9/11 in code in NES? The Xbox naming is very interesting, how they put it together. But the reach and the numbers associated with gaming, I mean, Jason, do you suppose this is part of the reason why children now, when the parents want to punish them, they force them to go outside? When I was young, outside was all there was. I mean, we didn't want to go home because there was nothing to do at home. That worm has turned, but gaming is massive, to say the very least.
The big difference I remember going from the Atari to the Nintendo was the Nintendo games were much more immersive. They were long playing. You went on this big quest and things like that, where with the Atari games, it's kind of like once you got the hang of them, got kind of boring.
Well, the first one that I ever saw, and it was a big deal because it was on your television. All of a sudden, your television was interactive, and it was a whole new world. That game was Pong. There were two paddles and a ball that bounced back and forth and beeped. And it was a pretty big deal for a while. Then people complained it got boring. So they did things like shrink the paddle, speed it up. And then the other gaming started to come in, and it was a big deal, but the graphics were horrible. And still, it was a big deal. And I think the numbers you had told me, Jason, might have been close to the turn of the millennium. Do you remember?
I don't remember the number, but it was in the billions.
I think it might have been 99 or 2000 where the value of all gaming eclipsed. I think it was even sports, movies, and music. It was a big, big number. And I would remind everybody of the movie that came out not too long ago, Ready Player One. And I would also remind people a thing I've mentioned a few times in the Marvel movies, which were top of the pops right before COVID. You remember Iron Man pointing out that someone was secretly playing Galaga? Seems like a funny thing to say, but even funnier to say twice. But anyhow, let's move on.
On November 19th and 20th, 1985, the Geneva summit brings together President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev in a historic meeting that signals a tentative step toward easing the decades-long Cold War tensions, setting the stage for transformative U.S.-Soviet diplomacy in the 1980s. It was hosted at the Maison de Saussure and Chateau Fleur d'Eau in the neutral nation of Switzerland, with the summit being the first U.S.-Soviet leadership encounter since the Carter-Brezhnev talks in 1979, said to be driven by Gorbachev's reformist ascent in March of 1985 and Reagan's desire to curb the nuclear arms race. The leaders discussed nuclear disarmament, human rights, and regional conflicts, with Reagan pressing Gorbachev on Soviet abuses and Gorbachev challenging U.S. militarism, particularly SDI, which the Soviets feared would destabilize the nuclear balance. No treaties emerged from the summit, but a joint statement affirmed that a nuclear war cannot be won and must never be fought, with both sides agreeing to future summits. Informal moments, like fireside chats at a lakeside boathouse, fostered a personal connection, with Gorbachev's openness contrasting with his predecessor's rigidity. Geneva's modest success, being amplified by global media, restored hope for détente and paved the way for the 1986 Reykjavik summit and the 1987 INF Treaty. This also showcased Reagan's shift from confrontation to negotiation and Gorbachev's willingness to engage, encapsulating the 1980s complex interplay of rivalry and reconciliation.
All the world is a stage, and as far as I know, it has been forever and ever and ever. What's Gorbachev worried about SDI? Isn't that the Star Wars thing, Jason?
It is.
It's fake. Never materialized. Was never a thing. I think they'll tell you a story like they needed to tell that lie to win and all these other things. But what are they meeting about here? Nukes. I have said on many occasions, nuclear weapons do not exist as described. And if that was a correct statement for me, if I'm correct in saying that, what does it mean about everything that was put out on the world stage here? As a matter of fact, it almost seems like the need for Russia to be a permanent enemy is to help keep the nukes can destroy the world argument alive. What do you think, Jason?
Always a possibility, because we certainly saw that happening.
Always a possibility.
On January 28th, 1986, the Space Shuttle Challenger disintegrates just 73 seconds after liftoff from the Kennedy Space Center, killing all seven crew members in a tragedy that stuns the world and will reshape NASA's trajectory. The mission, STS-51L, was the 25th shuttle flight and was garnering widespread attention because of Krista McAuliffe, a New Hampshire teacher who was chosen to inspire students as the first civilian in space, with millions watching the launch live, including school children, via classroom broadcasts. At 11:38 a.m. EST, under an unusually cold Florida temperature of 36 degrees Fahrenheit, Challenger launches, but a catastrophic failure in an O-ring seal on the right solid rocket booster allows hot gases to escape, igniting the external fuel tank and causing a massive explosion at 48,000 feet. Debris rained into the Atlantic, with no survivors being found, though recovery efforts later retrieved the crew cabin. The disaster, which would later be attributed to the O-ring's inability to seal in cold weather and NASA's decision to launch despite engineers' warnings, exposed a culture of complacency and schedule-driven decision-making as detailed in the Rogers Commission report, which criticized NASA and contractor Morton Thiokol. President Reagan addresses the nation, mourning the Brave Seven and vowing to continue exploration while appointing a commission that will include Sally Ride and Richard Feynman to investigate. The space shuttle program is paused until 1988, with safety overhauls being implemented.
Oh, the space shuttle. Let's see. It happened at 11:38. There's 11:11. What was the temp? 36. That's 666. There's so much about this that people have broken down. Jason, do you recall if this is the one where people tried to show all the supposed astronauts after this? Is that this one? Do you know?
Yes. And six of the seven astronauts seem to have people who looked remarkably like them and had similar names.
I'll leave that up to you folks to parse through. But go back and listen to what the words that Reagan says. You know, it's quite interesting to say the least. But the whole shuttle thing, and we've covered this, I think, more than once, was so expensive to do all these things that it really never did. And then at some point, they just walk away. Well, there's still an ISS up there. And how do we get there? We go to our mortal enemies in Russia to hitch a ride. All the world is a stage. And from in my book, this is no different.
On July 1st, 1979, the first personal stereo cassette player called the Sony Walkman had debuted for sale, sparking a revolution in portable electronics. Sony was, and still is, a Japanese electronics giant known for innovations like the transistor radio in 1955 and the Trinitron TV in 1968, and they saw an opportunity to revolutionize audio. The Walkman's concept originated with Sony co-founder Masaru Ibuka, who wanted a compact device to listen to music during travel. Engineer Nobutoshi Kihara adapted the Pressman, a portable cassette recorder that was used by journalists, by removing the recording function and speaker, adding stereo playback, and pairing it with lightweight headphones. The prototype that was developed in just 4 months was designed for individual use, a radical departure from the 1970s collective music culture. Sony chairman Akio Morita championed the project, envisioning a device that would appeal to young mobile consumers. The final product, the TPS-L2, was named the Walkman to evoke freedom and movement, and featured a blue and silver metal case, dual headphone jacks for sharing with a friend, and a hotline button for talking without pausing the tape. It was launched in Japan on July 1st, 1979, for 33,000 yen, or about 150 American, and was marketed as a lifestyle product, with ads showing young people jogging or skating to music. Its U.S. release followed in 1980 as the Soundabout, which would quickly be rebranded also as the Walkman due to the name's global appeal. The Walkman TPS-L2 debuted with modest expectations, with Sony projecting 5,000 units monthly, but sold out 30,000 units in Japan within weeks. By 1980, Sony had sold 1.5 million Walkmans worldwide, with 385,000 in the U.S. alone. Its $150 price, or about $550 in 2025 money, targeted affluent youth, but its appeal spanned ages, from teens to professionals. By 1983, competitors like Toshiba with the Walkie and Panasonic flooded the market, but Sony's brand dominated. By 1986, Sony had sold 50 million Walkmans across 60 countries and sees the term Walkman being added to the Oxford English Dictionary. The Walkman pioneered the idea of personal electronics, paving the way for devices like the Nintendo Game Boy in 1989 and the Apple iPod in 2001, as well as smartphones a few years after that.
This was a big step forward, to say the very least. 50 million units. I don't quite understand how they project 5,000 units, but luckily made enough to sell 30,000 within weeks, but I guess they were planning very carefully. Sony did a number of things that really started to bridge into the future. This is one of them. This is the first time that you could easily go out into your day with your music in your pocket. It wasn't that easy because you needed cassette tape at first, and that changed too. But if you had two or three cassettes, for the first time, you could be anywhere and listen to your music. Before this, they put out the Sony Trinitron. I don't know if any of you remember the Trinitron, but this was before the engineered failure. My mother bought a Trinitron, the first color TV we ever had in the late 80s, and that thing lasted 30 years. That thing was tough, tough, tough. But to get back to the point, this was a game changer. And I view the Walkman, and I had one, as really truly a bridge to where we were headed.
The Trinitron also looked considerably better than most other televisions, which really made an impact.
Right. The older TVs all had the dial and the kind of analog looking controls, and the Trinitron started to change that. But the color was good, and they weighed a ton, I'll tell you that. Took two people to move a Trinitron of any size, but they literally lasted forever. And I've told the story before. I brought one home from the military when I separated. I'd only had it a year and it failed. I hired a guy to fix it, and it was, I don't know, a 50-cent part, a little black barrel. I forget what it was. And he told me they engineered this piece to fail so that you have to get a new one. And I paid him very little to fix that one piece.
On April 26th, 1986, the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in Soviet Ukraine becomes the site of the world's worst nuclear disaster when an explosion in its number 4 reactor unleashes a deadly cloud of radioactive particles, exposing the Soviet Union's vulnerabilities and shaking global confidence in nuclear energy. The catastrophe is said to have occurred during a late-night safety test at 1:23 a.m. when a flawed reactor design, combined with operator errors and inadequate safety protocols, triggered a steam explosion and fire that destroyed the reactor core, releasing radiation that was possibly hundreds of times more than what the Hiroshima bomb was supposed to have been. The graphite-moderated RBMK reactor's inherent instability, exacerbated by a power surge during the test, was worsened by Soviet secrecy and cost-cutting measures. Pripyat, a town nearby with a population of 50,000, was evacuated 36 hours later, but initial Soviet cover-ups delayed worldwide awareness until Swedish monitoring stations detected radiation on April 28th, forcing Moscow to admit the accident. The disaster killed 31 people immediately, being mostly firefighters and plant workers, while thousands later died from what were called radiation-related illnesses. Millions of people across Europe also faced exposure risks, with Ukraine, Belarus, and Russia being the hardest hit. The cleanup, involving 600,000 liquidators, cost billions and left a 30-kilometer exclusion zone that is said to still be uninhabitable today. President Reagan used the Chernobyl incident to criticize Soviet mismanagement, while the disaster fueled Gorbachev's reforms, hastening glasnost and exposing systemic flaws. Chernobyl's legacy of environmental devastation would lead to tightened nuclear safety standards.
All right, I'm going to be blunt here. This is poppycock. Nuclear weapons do not exist as described, and neither do nuclear facilities in the way you're being told here. They're still telling you this is uninhabitable. I saw Anthony Bourdain go there some time ago with an X-ray badge on. You're fine if you just don't go by this many magic minutes. And by the way, the trees and the wildlife are thriving like you can't imagine, although I think they do occasionally try to get a picture of a three-eyed beaver or something to put out to convince you this is real. In my mind, this is a land grab. And don't ask me what happened to all the money for the supposed cleanup here in the same way that Fukushima was a land grab. And that's where I'm at. So there's the blunt down and dirty.
Having begun its run on September 20th, 1984, and running until April 30th, 1992, The Cosby Show was an NBC sitcom created by comedian Bill Cosby, as well as Ed Weinberger and Michael Leeson. It dominated the ratings, topping Nielsen charts for 5 seasons, from 1985 until 1990, peaking at a 27.8 rating in 1986-87, which was about 24 million households. The Cosby Show portrayed an affluent black family who were upper middle class and lived in Brooklyn, New York. This was revolutionary for the time and is considered to have been widely influential. The family's name was the Huxtables and were led by Cliff, who was an obstetrician, played by Bill Cosby, and Claire, who was an attorney, played by Felicia Rashad. The show also followed their five children named Sandra, Denise, Theo, Vanessa, and Rudy. The show's humor, warmth, and focus on universal family dynamics made it a ratings juggernaut and cultural touchstone. Since The Cosby Show was such a ratings powerhouse, it was considered part of NBC's Thursday night must-see TV lineup. The show's finale drew 44.4 million viewers, which was a testament to its enduring draw. Cumulatively, it averaged a 20.6 rating across all seasons, making it one of the most-watched sitcoms ever. It helped NBC dominate 1980s television, anchoring with other mighty shows like Cheers and Family Ties. Its viewership was remarkable in an era where there were considerably fewer channels, but its appeal crossed racial and demographic lines, which was considered a rarity until that time. Bill Cosby, who was already a comedy legend by the 1980s, had significant influence with the show, and he envisioned it so that it avoided stereotypes and instead focused on family. He worked closely with writers to ensure authenticity, often drawing from his own life, such as Cliff's love of jazz marrying Bill Cosby's.
This is a heck of a thing. It was a big deal. It was a show that centered around family values. And I'll ask a simple question. What would culture be like if media portrayed family-centric ideas like this, particularly to the Black community, as opposed to things like gangster rap? And I always wonder, was Bill Cosby's contract up? That man was involved in a lot of firsts, but look where he is now. Every effort was made to defame him. I mean, every effort. They have painted him into maybe the worst person that you've ever known. And it just goes to show you, I guess you can't have positive ideas being put out on television and things like that in the modern era. And have you noticed, Jason, I don't watch TV, but I'm not familiar. I don't think this runs anymore. Does this show even run anymore? Do you know?
I couldn't tell you. I don't watch television hardly ever.
It seems like maybe not. I might be wrong there, but I think it's pretty clear that there are very few examples of something that was centered around family values, particularly for ethnicity, that made it to such levels. And look what happened in the end. Someone got to tear that thing down. Someone did tear that thing down.
This is the example I like to use, that the whole black-white thing was not a very big deal by the time the 1980s came around. And it was very evident into the 90s as well, because how many huge black stars, black music was so popular, like everything, nobody cared. It wasn't until the 2000s, once Obama's in, that you see any kind of issue, where it seems they had to start making a divide again because people were pretty much over it.
Right. I think we have to be a little bit careful because depending on where you live, because I did go to places where it was like my jaw dropped, like this is really still going on. But like you, most of the world was not that concerned with any of this. And it goes to show you that when they use media and politics to play the race card, to play the political card, or many other things, they get dividends every single time. But if this was such a big deal, why isn't it in constant syndication now? I think they're still playing Seinfeld around the clock. I think maybe Big Bang and some of the other shows that were up at this level, they're played all the time. Seems to me this was damn near erased. It's not really part of culture anymore.
I would suggest it's because of the disgrace of Bill Cosby.
Well, I would suggest that that was engineered and you probably don't know one true thing about the man. And that becomes crystal clear when it goes coast to coast, international, to rip someone down at the level they did to him. Was a true word ever said? I don't know, but I'm not interested.
Well, I could tell you one thing for sure. I really liked Jell-O pudding pops.
So did he. Oh, we almost forgot. Even back in the 70s, he had a cartoon that was ethnic. I think it was called Cosby Kids or the Cosby Gang.
Fat Albert.
No, Fat Albert. That was it. And again, that tried to edge towards more family values.
On October 11th and 12th, 1986, the Reykjavik Summit in Iceland once again brings U.S. President Ronald Reagan and Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev together with the intent of signing a revolutionary nuclear disarmament agreement, only to see negotiations unravel over the U.S.'s Strategic Defense Initiative, yet still setting the stage for future arms control breakthroughs. The summit was held at the Hofty House and was meant to build on the 1985 Geneva Summit's rapport, but escalated when Gorbachev proposed eliminating all nuclear weapons within a decade, and Reagan countering with a plan to abolish ballistic missiles and share SDI technology. The discussions reached a dramatic impasse when Gorbachev demanded SDI be confined to laboratory research, fearing it would give the U.S. a strategic edge, a condition that Reagan rejected, unwilling to compromise his Star Wars vision that he had announced back in 1983. The collapse was witnessed by aides like George Shultz and Eduard Shevardnadze and was called a bitter moment, but the summit's candid exchanges clarified positions and built trust, paving the way for the 1987 INF Treaty, which eliminated intermediate-range nuclear missiles. Though Reykjavik ended without a deal, it did shift the Cold War toward more cooperation, with Reagan and Gorbachev's willingness to dream big together to work toward reducing nuclear stockpiles.
Nuclear stockpiles. You know, our first clue should be when they start naming things after movies. Maybe that's a clue that this is all entertainment. So Reagan doesn't want to agree, but I'll tell you what, we'll talk about abolishing ballistic missiles. Do we still have those, Jason?
We do, yes.
We do. And they're going to share SDI. That was made up, right? That was never a thing. The whole Star Wars thing was just nonsense. And what's this whole meeting about? Nuclear weapons, which don't exist as described. All the world is truly a stage. And I was being dead serious when I said, when they start naming things after a movie, maybe you should take a closer look on how serious the whole topic is.
On November 3rd, 1986, the Iran-Contra affair erupts into public view when Esh Shirah, a Lebanese magazine, reveals a secret U.S. operation that entangled the Reagan administration in a web of illicit arms deals and covert funding, which shakes the public trust and exposes the shadowy side of Cold War foreign policy. The scandal centered on two interconnected schemes. The first one was that the U.S. sold weapons, including TOW missiles, to Iran, which was officially a terrorist state under an arms embargo, in the hopes of securing the release of American hostages that were being held by Hezbollah in Lebanon. The second was that the profits from these sales were being diverted to fund the Contra rebels who were fighting Nicaragua's Sandinista government, which circumvented the Boland Amendment, a congressional ban on such aid. It was orchestrated by National Security Council aide Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, with involvement from figures like National Security Advisor John Poindexter and CIA Director William Casey. The operation began in 1985 and had involved intermediaries like Israel and shady arms dealers. The Esh Shirah report, that was based on leaks from Iranian officials, detailed how the U.S. had shipped arms to Iran, contradicting President Reagan's public vow to never negotiate with terrorists. Reagan initially denied the allegations, but by November 25th, he would admit to the arms sales, claiming that they aimed to foster ties with Iranian moderates, while Attorney General Edwin Meese revealed the Contra funding link, which prompted a firestorm. Investigations, which would include the Tower Commission and congressional hearings in 1987, exposed a rogue operation, with Oliver North's televised testimony captivating audiences. President Reagan's approval ratings did drop, but his claim of ignorance, despite evidence suggesting his awareness, shielded him from impeachment. Oliver North and others faced convictions, which were later overturned, and the affair underscored the dangers of unchecked executive power.
Really, what all this does is it undermines our trust and our ability to have any faith in things. And when we continue to be proud of America, in the back of our minds, stuff like this is going on. All the world is a stage. the fall guy here put forward was Oliver North, and we're expected to believe that somehow this guy just does whatever he wants in the world. And later, he's on TV. Didn't he? I think he got his own TV show, didn't he, Jason? Do you know?
I think he became an anchor or something, but I'm not entirely certain.
It's all ridiculous. And this is part of the long, you know, whenever there's a big event like this, and this flooded the airwaves for quite some time, Oliver North became very famous. It's like they're getting you to look at the right hand so you don't look at what the left hand is doing. But overall, it's just, this happens again and again and again, and it just erodes any faith in any authority. And it leads to where we are now, basically, where nobody trusts anything.
And for the last point for hour one, in the mid-1980s, photography was dominated by analog film, a technology that was rooted in the 19th century with innovations like Joseph Nicéphore Niépce's first photograph in 1826. Kodak, a leader in photographic film since the 1880s, recognized the potential of digital technology to disrupt its core business. In 1975, Kodak engineer Steve Sasson had invented the first digital camera prototype, which was a bulky device that used a CCD sensor to capture a 0.01 megapixel image. By December of 1986, Kodak's research team under Sasson's leadership had developed the first megapixel sensor capable of capturing 1.4 million pixels, roughly 1400 by 1000 resolution. This sensor, built using CMOS, or complementary metal oxide semiconductor technology, marked a leap in image quality, approaching the resolution of 35mm film. The development was driven by advances in MOSFET scaling in the mid-1980s, enabling smaller and more efficient chips. The project was initially internal, as Kodak hesitated to commercialize digital cameras, fearing that they would cannibalize film sales. They would later be proven to be correct on this. And so, the 1986 sensor was only used in prototype devices and professional applications, such as studio photography and scientific imaging, rather than consumer products. The megapixel sensor marked a turning point for Kodak, though commercial digital cameras would be delayed until the Kodak DCS in 1991, which would be a $13,000 professional camera. It spurred competitors like Canon and Nikon to invest in digital imaging, accelerating the nation's transition from film. The sensor was adopted in fields like astronomy, where high-resolution imaging was critical, as well as medical imaging, enhancing diagnostics like X-rays. Digital photography becoming mainstream in consumer technology over the next few years makes image making easily accessible for the general public. By the 1990s, especially with JPEG compression in 1992, digital images would fuel online sharing, aligning with the explosion of the World Wide Web.
You know, in a lot of ways, Jason, and I'm at the epicenter of this, when I get my first telescope around 94, 95, whenever Hale-Bopp comet was around, and I'm still using film at this point. Now, you mentioned that things for astronomy need high resolution. Well, I got news for everybody. I'm out taking the images that I take of the sun now, and they are not high resolution. If you're getting 12 megapixels, you're doing pretty well. And what's the reasoning? Because when you shoot video, they have to save those files down. And so it's almost impossible to have quick enough things to store truly high-res imagery. So even at this point, into the new millennium, we are doing astronomy as amateurs with basically low resolution tools with not much of an option for the majority of us. Now, here's the rub. This is another downgrade in my book, but we can't see it as a downgrade because we've become so used to it and it is so handy. When I was back in 94 using an Olympus with film, it was so difficult. And if you made one mistake, well, that's a wasted piece of film that you just invested an hour or whatever it was. Then I had to take that, get it developed, spend all the money, wait the time. So when the digital option got here, everyone jumped. But what did we lose? We lost resolution from maybe an artistic standpoint. People who used to go out to use film took their time to get that one shot right. Where in the digital mindset, we just fire them off till we get what we want. But this is a major turning point, maybe even bigger than when the music goes digital. Do you remember this changeover, Jason?
Yes, I had a good friend at the time who was a very good photographer, and he was discussing this new technology.
If you go back and look at Shoot the Moon, when I shot the first lunar wave, I was shooting with a digital camera that was not a full-frame chip because it was what I could afford, and it's 16 megapixels. I did a big jump up to the Nikon, which was a full-frame chip, which was a big step up, but I think it, I don't even remember at this point, 40-some, maybe 50, I think it was 40-some megapixels. So even at that point, into the new millennium, the resolution is just not there for most people who can afford the tools. It's a step down, is my point, but nobody recognizes it because of how handy and how easy and how usable it is. But to this day, when I'm out doing astronomy, I hope and pray for the day when I can shoot the sun in true high resolution with like 100 megapixels, but that day is not very close. Anyhow, I think we're there. Anything more you want to add?
That's it for hour one. When we come back, we're going to pick up with President Reagan demanding to tear down this wall.
Tear down this wall. This has been hour one of episode 636. We're in the mid-80s at this point. Hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is crrow777radio.com. Members know to log in for the full episode. They get access to all the forums and comments sections. They can do what they please as long as they're polite. They can stream the two-hour film that I just referenced called Shoot the Moon. And you can see the transition from my 16 megapixels that goes up to something near 50 along the way. You can notice the difference if you pay attention. All members get exclusive access to my current solar work. I'm about to release the 17th member solar video now. And on the website, the solar stills are available for folks. With that, we're going to take a short break and we'll be back. I hope to see you logged in as a member. And I'd like to wish you all a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. There it is, man. Cheers.
enemies of knowing.